Welcome to the Due Diligence Podcast, where we explore how leaders make and execute their biggest decisions, from transactions to founding organizations to career pivots and beyond. This podcast is produced by Sipping Giant Capital. We connect executive talent and capital to invest in West Michigan businesses. To learn more, visit us at sippinggiantcapital.com or stop by our office in downtown Kalamazoo.
Good afternoon, Nick. How are you doing, sir?
Pretty good. How are you, Derek?
Good. Welcome to the podcast. I'll give a brief introduction and then let you kind of give the snapshot. So, Nick, the owner of Adam Evaluation, managing director and owner of Adam Evaluation, which was a valuation company started in 1979, well known in West Michigan. I think everybody uses Adam Evaluation for all their valuations. the best brand for sure. And the renowned expert in West Michigan on evaluation. So I thought, what a great guest to have on our podcast for owners, sellers, buyers, anybody that's in this kind of community of business transactions and due diligence and valuations and everything else. So why don't you give us a quick rundown of Adam Evaluation to start, if you want to give the 5-second commercial plug on
sure.
Your group, your firm, and what you want to do.
Sure. Well, and I appreciate the kind introduction as well. The name's a little bit self-explanatory, but we figure out what companies are worth. So, you could call us appraisers. We figure out what companies are worth for a variety of purposes, but usually kind of a common thread that goes through a lot of our work is some sort of transition in business ownership. So along the way, we've gotten to have a front row seat in a lot of different ownership transitions and see what works, see what doesn't, see what builds lasting value, see what erodes it. It's been a fun journey.
A fun journey. And you work with everybody. You work with business owners, you work with lawyers, you work with, trust advisors, anybody anywhere in this process, brokers, finance executives, and from small to multi-million, even billion-dollar businesses, correct?
Yeah. I think, when you think about the companies we work with, typically we're working with some combination of the owners and the C-suite executives. But at the same time, we're usually collaborating with their advisors. So often attorneys, CPAs, sometimes trustees, and other professionals, depending on what the transaction is. And the company profile, we don't really focus on any one particular industry, kind of a cross-section of the sort of Midwestern economy, although our clients are all over the country. But really anywhere from kind of lower middle market to upper middle market, and granted, everyone has their definition of that, but a few million dollars in revenues up to usually a few hundred million, and we've got a couple of outliers there that are a billion or two in revenues.
Okay. So today we're going to talk about two things. One, valuation and the process of valuation. I think that's important. But I think what the real fun of this podcast, where I was interested in and how we've been connecting lately, is building lasting value in companies.
Yeah.
And some of the pitfalls, some of the mistakes, some of the things people think build lasting value or change the value of their company. So let's kind of separate those two. And how do you as Nick or the leader of Adam Evaluation think about valuation versus building lasting value? Like, what are the difference between those two? And then we'll go into each of them and separate them apart. So how do you think about valuation versus building lasting value when you're advising clients, talking to business owners, and in general, just helping people improve the value of their business and the quality of the business?
Yeah, and I think that's a good way to kind of draw the line too, kind of dividing line, right? In terms of valuation, one way of thinking about it is we're measuring value. We're measuring results. Whereas building lasting value, those are all the things that the business owners, executives, leaders did to drive and eventually create those results that are translating into value. And in some ways, I can think back over the course of my career, and what got me into this career was an interest in finance, an interest, almost a mechanical interest, a love of the tools, right? The way the numbers come together. And that really is the measuring part, measuring the value of businesses based on their performance, the outputs. But over the years, what's become more and more interesting to me is I've seen patterns of what seems to not only correlate, but actually create lasting value. And as my career has evolved, that's become more interesting than just the mechanical piece of, say, measuring the results.
Yeah, I mean, since 79, you must have a lot of stories in both those
Well,
cases.
and now in fairness, 79 goes back to when my dad started. My career's not quite as mature as that, but at least for the last 2 decades, I've had the privilege of seeing a lot of different private businesses that most people don't get to see, pretty deep from the inside, getting to see their financial performance, getting to see really how their leadership team works, their culture, and then see the results and measure that in terms of how the market would value those results in that company.
Okay, yeah. And you got any what craziest stories? Because I when we give evaluation, we make an offer, the business owner never agrees with us. Does it ever happen where they're in 100% agreement with you? Because you're not quite on our side of the table, but
Yeah, well, oh, it's a great point because, from a from let's say from a customer service perspective, we can't guarantee that our clients are going to like our results. Right, we have to be the independent, objective expert who's going to come in, tell you what we believe, what we can stand behind, and in most situations, somebody has some sort of angle. Right. Everybody has their own kind of incentives in most of the deals that we're involved with. And we have to set those aside, but also be aware, right? Like this person who's giving us all the information about the company also may have their own agenda and like to see the value high or low, right? Depending on the situation. I can think of a couple situations. That made it clear that emotions were driving the client's reaction to our work rather than, logic or finance principles.
Yeah, emotions are at the heart of a lot of the stuff that we do, right? Both you and I, I'm sure.
It
It's
really
sometimes,
is. I'm thinking of, right, you asked me of maybe some war stories, and some of the situations we get involved in are after things have gone badly with an ownership transition. And I'm thinking in particular when we were hired through the attorneys on a shareholder dispute involving four brothers. Mom and dad left, four brothers, equal ownership in the business. And you can imagine how well that went. And they spent years in litigation. And ultimately, in the case the last case we were involved in with these four brothers, one of the brothers had been squeezed out and was holding out to get bought out at a much higher value than what we thought the company was worth. And they'd gone through multiple failed mediations. And somehow the last mediator clued into the fact that the holdout brother, wasn't actually the decision maker. His wife was the decision maker. And many years earlier, another brother got bought out at a higher price when the company was doing much better. And the wife kept reminding him of that and saying, if you take a penny less than your brother, you're not a real man. So can you imagine, right?
Yeah, like just the I don't know, masculinity or the pride or whatever you want to call involved. But
Right.
when we say business owners, I think what most people forget, I don't know if you have this experience too, is the family involved, right? Like
Often.
there's a spouse, whether it's and spouses, if there's multiple owners or partners or whoever they're living with, and there's family and there's children, and they all have influence on this decision. And
That's
sometimes
right.
the biggest decision maker can be that spouse,
Yeah.
in terms of selling, in terms of, I want to retire. I've already retired. I'm living in Florida. You need to sell this thing now, or don't take a penny less than that. We're not moving. Keep work. What are you going to do at home? You're going to be driving me crazy at home. Keep working, right? Like you get both of those in this whole valuation slash transaction, and it's just the emotions are high, which I always, firms like yours, like, well, let's get straight to the mechanical and the logic. So to remove emotion from this, I understand there's emotion always involved, but if the data can drive this at all, that's ideal. So why don't we start fundamentals of a valuation? Because I think to me as well, like the valuation is just like we got to get to a number. We all like the business. Let's agree on something where we both feel like we kind of win lose. But the second part of our conversation of like building lasting value, I think that's going to be more intriguing to me anyway. So let's start about basic of evaluation. Like what is the fundamental evaluation, and how do you guys approach that?
And so, first of all, we try to put ourselves in the shoes of a hypothetical buyer, right? So, and I always tell people a cold-blooded financial investor with, no emotional attachment to the business. And we use generally the same tools as most financial buyers use.
I'm going to use that cold-blooded financial
Cold-blooded.
investor with zero emotion in the business. Okay.
Exactly. Well,
I got a new seat at my table when I'm thinking about things.
And it frankly, it's a way of diffusing the situation, especially if I know I'm going to tell them something they don't want to hear. Right? Like you're basically your baby's ugly. But it's not me, it's math, right? So, going back to the math, there's kind of, in some sense, you can boil it down to really just one fundamental concept, and there's different tools to apply that concept. And the same concept applies whether you're valuing a business, a stock, a bond, even in some cases, assets like equipment, a rental property, anything that can be boiled down to a cash flow stream and a rate of return can use these same principles. And essentially, it does boil down to that. What kind of profits, and usually in terms of cash, will this business, this investment generate for me in the future? You're making an educated guess about that. And given the risk of this investment, given where else I can put my money, what kind of rate of return do I need to get? So when I get those profits, it's giving me a rate of return that I can feel good about. With those two inputs, you can do simple math to figure out what price do I pay today so that those cash flows give me my target rate of return. The example I like to use is think about real estate. Think about you want to get into the landlord game, and you're going to buy a rental property, and you find a small apartment building that generates, let's say, $10,000 a month in rental profits, right after paying expenses and all that. So $120,000 a year in cash flow. And you've looked around at other investments and decided, you know what, if I can get a 10% rate of return, I'm going to feel pretty good about this. So now you've got everything you need to figure out what price do you pay. So that $120,000 a year works out to a 10% rate of return. I picked a number I can do in my head. So $1.2 million works out to a 10% rate of return when you get that $120,000 a year. That same concept, and frankly, even the same mechanics apply to valuing a business. It's just that we get a little bit more complicated. We may project out cash flows every year for several years rather than just assume an average. And there's a lot of analysis that goes into deciding what is the market rate of return, what is the risk of this business, and so on. But fundamentally, that's the concept.
So real simply now, and you must have the same challenge as we do when an owner says, well, great, we haven't done this in the past, but in the next 5 years we're going to make double what we've made in the previous 3 years. So simple your DCF, right? How much cash flows are coming back, discount that today by rate of return, you get what you have. How do you handle that situation with the owner when he says, well, how do you actually predict or get predict the next 5 years of return? Real estate, good. I have that many apartments and they rent at this amount. It's a little bit simpler. Business, the complexity goes to customer concentration and all these other types of things that get involved in valuation.
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah. And so while the fundamental concept and the math is pretty straightforward, the devil's in the details, and it really comes down to how do you come up with a reasonable estimate of future profits, future cash flows, and how do you come up with a useful estimate of a rate of return? And both of those are challenging exercises, and it depends on the business. Obviously, the more mature, stable the business is, if it's been trucking along doing this every year with a little bit of increase, well, it's pretty easy to extrapolate that, right? Mm-hmm. But you're right, there's the classic hockey stick projections that I'm sure you see all the time.
And, oh, all the time.
Right, and we see in some instances we see those, in other instances, depending on the motivations of the executive team or the owners, we might see a cliff, right? Well, yeah, that was unusual, and you know the world is falling apart, and you know next year is going to be a lot worse. So we definitely have to take things with a grain of salt, understand where the information we're getting is coming from, do our due diligence just like a buyer. And we're gonna place a lot of weight on historical performance, but we want to understand why did the company perform this way over the last few years? What's the story behind the numbers? Was it a fluke? Is it a trend? You know, thinking of a project we did, right after the pandemic, you know, in that period where construction was just booming, right? And because of shortages, prices were going up, and if you had the materials, you could charge pretty much whatever you want. Well, we were working with a company in that industry. They had been investing for about 5 years in building their infrastructure, building additional distribution capacity, and they were on the cusp of a pretty big explosion. And then, you know, all of a sudden, they got this explosion, but at the same time, everybody else was getting this explosion. So it was really hard to tell. I think their EBITDA went from just trucking along at $3 to $5 million and then jumped up to 15 and then 20 something million EBITDA. Mm. And so how much of that was at the one time COVID bump versus the new normal because of the intentional investments that they made? And so, you know, they didn't get the full credit for, say, $22 million in EBITDA. We projected them more in the mid-teens with some modest growth after that. And coupled with that, to your point about, you know, also understanding risk, we used a pretty high discount rate, a pretty high rate of return to reflect that higher risk of, we don't know if this is the new normal or not.
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic of all the tragedy it caused, it made valuation really hard.
It did.
it just in general of some businesses spiked, some trenched downward, some then came out with the big pop and then normalized. And so you're looking for trends to establish. Well, it's not a consistent business. Well, is it not consistent because of the pandemic, or is it just not consistent all the time under normal circumstances, right? By and large, under normal circumstances, what does this look like? So we're getting past that, I feel, finally.
Yeah.
But for a few years, it was really hard to understand what was the result of what and what's causing this. It's so hard to predict that. So I got another question for you as we're on this, because, you know, you mentioned the I don't know what kind of word back call it. I almost said the devil word, but you mentioned the word
EBITDA. Devil's in the details. Oh, EBITDA. Yeah.
Devil's in the details. Yeah. And then you guys mentioned EBITDA.
We need to talk about EBITDA, because there's some devils in that detail.
Oh my God. Is there some devils when companies in the size that we look at, I'm sure you look a lot of our size. There's a lot of things in that calculation. It's very complex. So one, you said cash flows of the future, bring it back to today. So you get the problem of extrapolating the future when owner says we're going to grow at 10 times the rate. It's like, well, then you can take all that and earn out, right? That's how we would do it as if we're buying, but we'll give you this rate and this rate of return. But then there's EBITDA and EBITDA multiples that have this valuation game. So talk about, I personally, we use it because the market uses it in our office, but I, I am a cash flow, free cash flow person in general. That's where my heart is. That's what pays the bills. So talk about EBITDA, EBITDA multiples, and how that plays into your valuation. Because the
Well,
market and the broker, everyone's using multiples, and it's like, what are you even multiplying? You don't even know what you're multiplying on.
and what, right? And where's the connection to reality? So, yeah, and this is one of the biggest challenges we have in communicating with clients about expectations around valuation. Because I think the attraction of EBITDA multiples is the simplification. It's easy to wrap your head around. Everyone can talk about it. It's things, people can brag about an exciting deal without having to, I guess, maybe be crass about quoting numbers, but 9 times EBITDA, right? That's something to brag about at the golf course. I think in the popular culture around M&A, EBITDA multiples end up driving the conversation because they're easy to talk about. The reality is you're cramming a ton of information into just one number. And ultimately, and I think, right, you mentioned you're a cash flow guy. Warren Buffett would agree with you, right? Ultimately, it is about what kind of cash flow will this generate and what kind of rate of return do we need? I mean, that's the whole story. And the beauty of EBITDA multiples, this might come out wrong. I say the beauty. One of the attractions, besides being simple, easy to talk about, is it allows you to let someone else do the work for you. Well, they paid 5 times EBITDA, they paid 6 times EBITDA. That should be our value, right? You're letting somebody else who did their due diligence on that deal do your work for you in terms of coming up with effectively a rate of return. And there is, I'll be loose, there is a connection between EBITDA multiples and the discounted cash flow analysis or capitalization, right? And I mean, realistically, it's just the inverse of a capitalization rate, a rate of return. The two biggest challenges, one, EBITDA is not cash flow. And that can make a real big difference, especially if you've got a capital-intensive business.
We
Besides,
buy some manufacturers personally, so we buy manufacturers everyone says, "Oh, this is the EBITDA." Well, show me the balance sheet. Do you see the spend every year? Do you see the amount of machinery there? Or the R&D and some that's hidden on some of these balance sheets. Yeah, it's a thing. But yeah, the D in manufacturers, the D is actually an expense.
It totally is. And yeah, we I'm thinking of a couple instances where we did a valuation of a very capital intensive construction company that bought a lot of equipment. They bought a lot of equipment for a lot of reasons that weren't entirely economical. And we were looking at multiples on comps at 5 to 6 times EBITDA. It was a good sized business, so over $100 million in revenues. Our DCF was coming up with 3 times EBITDA. And we were scratching our heads until we took a hard look at capital expenditures and compared this company with the public companies we were comparing them with. Public companies were spending on average 20 to 30% of EBITDA on CapEx. This company was spending 50 to 60% on CapEx. Between that and growth and working capital, they were generating no cash flow. So,
Yeah, the
you're good.
craziest one I've seen in the market in the last 2 years was someone pitched us a $3 million EBITDA company that was negative cash flow. And I was like, what? And everyone thinks I'll make this up. And I said, I can give you the SIM. If you sign an NDA, we can talk about it, but it's not my SIM, so I can't share it. But it's legitimately like we see that. But other companies like heavy service companies, I mean, even it is cash flow. It's almost
Then it is
equivalent. It
totally.
it's very equivalent. So I get that part of it. And then you get the multiple thing. How does the multiple play into to, because there's multiple in deal structure and valuation, right? I can give you any. There's Brent Beecher. I think I got it from him or someone like this that says, "Give me your price as long as I get to pick the terms, right? I'll get you to your multiple, but I get to pick the terms, right?" You want $1 billion? We'll do an earnout on $1 billion. You can have it all, but you're never going to get it all.
Right. You're getting 10 million cash at closing, though.
Yes, right. So talk about that, the multiples and how often that impacts your guys. Is it frustrating for you guys? Is it help you communicate because it's simple? What is it?
And I think the more difficult thing is multiple of what? When you've got, right, yes, it's EBITDA. We talked about, the disconnect with cash flow with capital intensive companies. But when you've got a company that's got volatile performance, like, right, the company I told you about a few minutes ago with EBITDA, 3, 5 million, 15, 20 plus, what are you going to apply a multiple to? And is it an average? Is it peak? And that can really drive some huge disconnects in terms of expectation, where is this performance sustainable? Is it repeatable, or is it a fluke? So that's a huge wild card. But once you get over that, there still is, to your point, a lot of noise around the multiples, especially when you are getting anecdotal evidence from the market. You're getting people talking about deals. You're getting people pitching deals that once you start peeling back the layers of the onion, you start seeing, all right, well, this was advertised or pitched as a 9x EBITDA offer, but there's 2 turns of EBITDA are an earnout, 1 turn's in escrow. Oh, and it's an asset deal, so we're going to pay a lot more in taxes. Plus, there's rollover equity, and at a optimistic valuation for the rollover, and right on and on. So I think one of the euphemisms that I always chuckle at is the idea of the headline price. And it almost, right, it almost sort of acknowledges the fact that, well, this isn't really cash, it's the headline price. But nonetheless, right, that sometimes can be used to get some people's attention.
Yeah, it gets some people's attention for sure. And then there's I always hear, when we do deep dives into some company and we say, well, here's our offer, and they say, well, someone said, one of my advisors, my lawyer, someone said they can get me 7x cash. And I'm like, seven x of what? Seven
Right.
x like what are they multiplying that on? I'll get you 7x of a dollar. Like, sure, but what's the how are they calculating the what they're multiplying?
Yep.
And if they can get that based on what we're multiplying, then you should go take it. Like that's a great deal for you. You should get that, right? We get that a lot too, which is interesting. Because EBITDA, people start to adjust that thing all over the place, and sometimes it makes rational sense. I mean, you must see sometimes there's the owners, partners, cars in the business. Well, it's not part of I get that, right? That makes sense. But then they start to get a little they reach too far with their ad backs. How's that?
And that can be a challenge for us as well. And we can have some uncomfortable conversations about, yeah, well, we're adding about half of these things back, but not necessarily all of them. And either way, that gets to risk too, right? I mean, if you got clean financial statements with no ad backs, a buyer is going to be a lot more confident about that. And all else equal, that company's going to go for a higher price.
Right. I mean, so that if it's clean, there's not a lot of ad backs, it's trustworthy. I always say, are you going to have that expense the day after you close? If it's there, you can't add it. Like it's simple. Like keep it that simple. That's what we say. So, but let's. I want to move on to the second part of this conversation, right? Because it real tough. But quickly, I want to give you a chance. Just if an owner is going to do evaluation. So last question on this. How much time would that take? What would they expect from working with you? When we do diligence, it can be a pretty deep dive and a lot of questions and a lot of time around the financials and things like that. Give it an owner just an expectation of them to get evaluation from an expert like you that's accurate. What would that take? Timeline and like what would they go through?
Well, and I think on one hand, it's definitely a more involved process than a real estate appraisal. And we're gonna we're going to be working hand in hand with management. We're going to be interviewing management. But the due diligence is nowhere near as intense as it would be for an M&A deal. So I think, you know, maybe that might be a little bit of a relief. You know,
A relief for them to tell you something they don't want to hear, right? You have to
well,
upset your customer. How much do they
that's
have to
right.
engage with you for you to upset them is what I have really asked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And so, you know, generally the process for us takes 4 to 6 weeks, and we usually start the clock ticking from when we get the information, because it can take a while to pull that stuff together. And you know, when I say the information, we're looking for a lot of the same stuff that a buyer would look for, but not in as much detail. We're not doing legal due diligence. We're not doing regulatory compliance, you know, due diligence. We're not doing an environmental phase one. We're mostly looking for historical financial statements, budgets, forecasts, business plans. We want to understand how sales break down, whether that's by top customer to understand customer concentration, by business line, product line, service line, things like that. Corporate documents to understand restrictions on transfer. If we get a complicated ownership structure, capital structure, you know, to understand the waterfall, if you will, things like that. But the most important step in the process is the management interview. In many cases, we'll meet in person. We usually meet with 3 to 4 members of the leadership team, spend a couple hours talking through the business. And it's not a detailed accounting discussion. It's tell us the story of the business. Who do you serve? How do you do it? How do you compete? What makes you special? What are the challenges? What's the story behind the numbers for the last few years? We'll tour the facility, try to get a flavor of culture, some of the soft stuff. And really, it's an informal conversation. We're not looking for a PowerPoint management presentation. It's tell us what you know. You don't have to prepare.
And then you guys retain that information, you process with your team, you look at
that's
comps
right. We go
and
back,
things
yep.
and
go back,
do
do
your
our
process.
Analysis, put together the report, send the report in draft form, and then we sit back down with the client and whoever they want included in that conversation. Sometimes it's a leadership team, particularly if they're doing, say, a management incentive plan, an equity incentive plan. Sometimes it's going to be the advisors, the attorney, CPA. And we'll send it in advance, and then we'll sit down and talk through it and explain how it's done, make sure the client understands how we got there. We're not asking if they like the conclusion, but we do want to make sure they understand how we got there and they're comfortable that it's a credible, supportable conclusion.
Okay, good. I think that's good for anybody to hear. This is how it works. That's a lot of work just to get to a 5x multiple. Just kidding. It takes you that long to give them a multiple? I'm
right,
just
exactly.
Totally kidding.
I could have told you that at the beginning.
Yeah, but in general, it's a good process. It's a learning process for everybody. And sometimes it's good to have that follow-on conversation, I imagine, just to get like, this is everything we saw. If you think we're wrong, tell us we're wrong.
Yeah.
This is the information you gave us.
To that point, I think, you know, I say we're not asking if anyone likes the conclusion. About 5% of the time through that conversation, we learn something that maybe we had overlooked or hadn't really considered, and we do change our conclusion. Again, we're not asking, you know, we're not trying to sell the conclusion or asking, you know, do you like this? But that is an opportunity for us to make sure, did we get it right? Is it supportable? But, you know, I think in a little bit of a transition to the next topic, one of the somewhat unexpected things that comes out of that conversation is, you know, a lot of times there'll be some maybe technical or compliance need that drives the need for evaluation. But then having someone from the outside who's seen 1,000 different companies, 1,000 different transactions, really, you know, take that cold-blooded look at the company and then explain, hey, here's how we see the business, here's how we think outside investors would see the business, becomes enlightening for the owner, because you've got somebody from the outside, independent, objective, who is giving you the cold hard truth about how investors see your business. And that often leads to the more interesting conversations about, all right, well, what does build lasting value, right? I thought this was a 9x EBITDA company, you're telling me it's 5x. How do I get How do I get to where I want to be?
Yeah, so let's do that. This is a perfect transition. So let's leave the, I'm going to read this, cold-blooded financial investor with zero emotion, Nick. And let's bring in Nick the coach now, right? You're the coach, you're on the team now. The patterns that you've seen over time, and you start to get pattern recognition. Let's talk about lasting value. So let's drop valuation, lasting quality value in a company, what buyers will pay for, what buyers are excited to see because they want to buy that and they'll pay more for it. Let's go through there. So peel back then, elaborate on what you mean by that and how you coach around that. And if there's key drivers and things like that.
And ultimately, right, what the buyers are going to pay for the performance. But the more interesting question is what led to that performance? And the really insightful, sophisticated buyers are going to see both. You know, they're going to see that second layer. They're going to see the performance, or everybody sees the performance. Everyone sees high EBITDA margins, high growth, high return on investment, fat cash flows, right? Everybody sees that. That's easy to see. But the more insightful buyers are going to see behind that to understand why the company was able to accomplish that. And more importantly, why that may be or may not be sustainable. And
That's
so
the key
that's,
question. That's a really good question right there, right?
yeah.
Why I see good performance, I'm in. Let's talk. Let's understand why this is happening. And B, is this sustainable? I'm gonna pay for what it is today, right? Here's the performance. Let's pay for, how's so go through that. How do you unpack that? I'm really, you got me listening now. I'm curious.
Well,
I'm in learning mode here.
well, and I have been too for the last 20 years because this wasn't stuff that we got taught in business school. I think they're starting to now, but it was not stuff that we got taught in business school. You know, it was hardcore finance and accounting, and yeah, there was some HR organizational behavior stuff. But that at the time was presented as disconnected from the hard world of finance and dollars. And what I've learned is ultimately kind of makes sense intuitively. It does all come down to people, right? That's all we have in our organizations is people. And so, yes, you have to have a good strategy. You have to have a business model that works and scales. But those things are somewhat temporary, right? A strategy is good for maybe 5 years.
Maybe
And
with AI
right.
today, maybe.
Right, exactly. Technology is hardly ever, I mean, technology may be good for a few months, right? These things can all be replicated, can be leapfrogged. The only durable competitive advantage that I've seen is culture. Now, that's easier. That's a little bit deceptive because it's not just any culture. Every organization has a culture, right?
That's a word that's thrown around a lot.
It
Means
is.
everything and anything at some points, right?
It is. So, what the kind of magic ingredients that I have seen that have led to truly great businesses with lasting value, yes, they have good strategies, they have good business models, but it rests on and it's aligned with first and foremost culture. Not just any culture, but a very intentional culture that is aligned with strategy. And then the leaders use process for all the things you use process for, and in addition, use process as the tool to reinforce the desired culture that they want to achieve. And by that, I mean baking in elements of the culture into the everyday activities that people do so that you remind and reinforce people what's important to us, how do we do things, why do we do things the way we do, so that we're taking advantage of human nature here and making the company's priorities second nature. So you curate your culture by being intentional with your process to reinforce that culture with the things people do every day, towards the goal of being able to empower people to operate at their highest potential. And by that, I mean when you have a combination of the right culture, and I should expand on that, right? Culture is rooted in human nature. We are social creatures. And you can think about culture really as the cornerstone of civilization. Religion is a great example of shared norms that a group of that bind a group of people together and direct their energies towards a common goal. Organizations can leverage that aspect of human nature to create a culture that binds people together and directs behavior with unwritten rules. So we don't have to write a rule book for every scenario. Behavior is really controlled by the culture. And so if you're intentional about your culture, you get the behavior that you want and the behavior that's directed towards the goals of the organization. So culture, unwritten rules that enforce behavior, reinforced with process, those two things together create guardrails. So now with those guardrails, you can free people, unleash people to use their highest and best skills, their judgment, to further the goals of the organization.
Very interesting.
Go ahead. Go ahead. There's lots of different directions we can take that. So I'll let
yeah, you left for,
dive in.
You left from mechanical financial creature to
social animals.
Profit, social animal kind of territory. Profits, right? So yeah, let's peel this back. So I want to ask you one crazy question because this happens
sure.
all the time, right? A business is performing well. Why is it performing well? And you're in West Michigan like we are. How many different businesses are West Michigan that you probably haven't heard of? You walk in, you're like, how is this thing making, like, what does this thing actually do? Like, what, I don't even understand the part that's coming out of here right now,
right.
But it's making money. I don't understand what's happening. You guys must experience that all the time with valuation work. Like, explain to me again exactly what you're making or what you're doing or like
you're, that is
you're making
one of the
what
most,
that does what?
That's one of the most fun things about what we do because – yeah, we're almost exclusively working with private companies, and especially when you're talking about industrial B2B businesses, right, they have no reason to advertise to the general public what they do. But so much of U.S. wealth is created inside these companies, and to see inside, to see what they do, it's fascinating because hardly anybody else gets that insight. But it's the backbone of the U.S. economy. In so many ways, it's the backbone of employment. It's the backbone of wealth creation that leads to philanthropy, community involvement. I mean, this really is sort of the engine of the American economy.
It really is. And you said people, right? And so when you talk about culture, that team, we talk at our investment model, we really talk about a context fit. So the CEO that we're backing to acquire a company has got to fit that company.
Yeah.
Has to fit the culture, has to fit what they do, has to understand. Because I'll walk in and I'll walk some of these I'm not an operator, right? Manufacturing floors with some of the engineers that we're backing to make acquisitions. And I'm like, do you understand what these machines are doing? Because I have no idea. I hope you understand this because we're on a tour and I don't understand any of this. But if you got it, I'm good.
Right.
But you have to trust your people, right? I can't understand everything. And then I get back out and I said, I walked that whole floor for like an hour. I still don't understand like what they're making. But it's a part that's critical to some downstream economy, and the economy in West Michigan that's built on this, that we Sleeping Giant Capital takes pride in keeping it local, right? And keeping it here and keeping the capital that it creates and the wealth that it creates here in West Michigan is more important than starting new things to us right now, right? You can start all the new things you want, but this wealth generation, the backbone, sponsoring
it's already
the little
here,
things.
right?
It's already here. Let's keep it here. But it's being extracted or liquefied by on the coast. They're just buying them and extracting all that wealth to the coast or to Chicago. And it's just like, this is tragic because you just go to your local rink or a soccer field and you'll see the names, right? That's where they show up on the jerseys, on the backs of the jerseys, on that's it, it really is the backbone. So anyway, total tangent there, but it's crazy
it's
how many
important.
Things it's important. It's crazy how many things are made here. It's incredible when I walk through and I'm like, I didn't even know you guys were here. And like, this is the coolest thing I've ever been. I still don't understand how it works, but it's so cool what comes out of here. You know, one of the companies that we ended up purchasing, it actually makes the consoles for a lot of trucks. And I'm like,
oh yeah,
that's in my truck.
That's the
that's
console.
so cool. Like, I look at my console totally different now. I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. And my wife's like, it's just a console. I'm like, no, this is, I see how this is made.
But all the engineering, you have no idea how much engineering went into just this thing that does this.
Just that thing, right? Or we talked about Justin's, like all the signs that SignComp makes. It's just amazing, incredible. I'm like, anyway. So, you know, shout out to West Michigan. Let's get back to lasting valuation, people important, top management team. A lot of financial buyers want that top management team to stay in place. We would replace them, say, no, we've got not the top management. We replace the CEO because the CEO wants to retire in most of our cases. And so we put a new CEO in that's a great fit for that company. That I can't underestimate. That's the most important thing to us. That CEO is a great fit. They'll figure it out, right? They'll solve it, and they're there to solve those problems, and they're really good at that. If we can do that, I think that's most of our investment. And beyond that, you know, there's the whole financial diligence and all the stuff we do. But if we can't get that perfect fit, then we get a little nervous.
I want to build on that because what you
Yeah,
said,
go ahead.
I think it is really relevant to this conversation in many ways, right? If you get the right person with the right fit to lead that company, they'll figure everything else out. So, back to earlier in this conversation where I said strategy is important, but you know it's not good for more than about 5 years, right? Technology is important. Those some of those details that we made a big deal out of in business school, right? The right leadership team with the right culture will figure those things out. And that's why culture is a durable competitive advantage, whereas strategy isn't.
Yeah, I could almost feel it. I mean, you must feel it. I can almost feel it after we're done the tour. And I always go on the tours with our, I try to, the CEOs. And after you leave, you can tell, it's okay. They kind of make it. I'm like, okay, it's not for you. Like, man, and the other times they're psyched up. They're so excited. They think it's the coolest tour. They love the product. They love the engineering and whatever else is behind all that. They love how it comes out. And they're just like so excited about it. And I'm like, yeah, this is probably a good fit. Let's go see what we can do. Right. And once you hit that point and they have conviction, then it's about solving the mechanics around the deal process and the structure and how we get to a price that's fair for everybody. Helps the person retire that wants to retire. So unpack this a little bit. So building, what are some pitfalls that an owner makes? Because some of them try to like change the value of their company quickly for sale. What are some pitfalls you see that owners do wrong? Let's see the other side of this. They're trying to build lasting value, but it's not, and everybody sees it. So go ahead.
There's a ton. And I think, you know, I would build on what you're talking about with the leadership team, right? It starts with a leadership team. You build the culture with the leadership team. You build the trust, right? You build the trust around the leadership team. And that is, you know, that is one of the key ingredients. There isn't a magic culture that works in all situations, but there are a few key ingredients that have to be there. And trust is one of them. And by trust, I mean, every employee, I mean, it starts with the leadership team, but every employee has to feel like, one, they can tell the truth and that they aren't going to be penalized for telling the truth, no matter how uncomfortable or unfavorable that truth is. And two, their coworkers and especially their supervisor has their best interest in mind. That's the kind of trust that is essential to an effective culture. And so, you know, it starts at the leadership team. It's really hard to have that trust out in the rest of the organization if the leadership team doesn't already have it amongst themselves. But then one of the challenges is how do you sort of radiate that through the organization? And that's part of where process comes in, because you design your processes to reinforce and reward that behavior, including trust building behavior, that has proven effective, right, in the small group of the leadership team. And one of the most powerful ways to do that is around how people are compensated, promoted, and how performance is measured, right? It's really putting your money where your mouth is. We say this is important. Are we actually rewarding and compensating people for what we say is important? So that's one of the, I think, most concrete ways where I've seen leaders use process, design process, to transmit a culture throughout the entire organization.
I'm going to peel back on this a bit, you know, process, right? There's really bad processes that get put in place in a lot of places and change things for the worse, right? People think they're fixing because, and it's sometimes they're put in place from a place of distrust.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I need a process that measures all this because no one's doing anything right. And it's,
I need
like,
to idiot proof this, right?
I'm going to idiot proof this. And that's my process.
Because all my
I
people are idiots.
I want to simplify. I need to, because my people can't do it right. And I'm like, why does that make sense? Like, I'm trying to understand why this process is here, right? And versus, you said something earlier, we put a process in place that unleashes the potential in your people, right?
Yeah.
Like, just get it enough so that, like, the quality check's there, but it's unleashing their power. It's unleashing your culture. It's unleashing what you guys do best. Can you explain some of that, or just dive deep into it for me?
Yeah. And, you know, if you've got a culture where there's a high degree of trust, where everybody is comfortable telling the truth,
Mm-hmm.
and identifying uncomfortable truths, here's a problem, right? Let's fix it. And you also have a culture of accountability. Hey, I know there's a problem and I'm going to fix it, or I've got a problem, I need your help fixing it, right? Those are two key elements as an example of a positive culture, where now that creates the guardrails where you don't need to micromanage people with detailed process. You need some process, and especially process that reinforces those positive behaviors that drive that culture. But you're not designing process to idiot-proof what people do. Instead, you use process in combination with culture to create those guardrails so that everybody knows where the guardrails are, and within those guardrails, they can use their judgment to make the best decisions. Take that a step further. The goal of this whole thing really is push down decision making as close to the point of impact as possible.
It's like empowerment,
right?
Almost, right? You're empowering people with your process. Like, how
that
do we
is the
empower?
Definition.
Design? Yeah.
Yes. So the people who are closest to the point of impact, often that means closest to the customer. In manufacturing, it means closest to the production line. How do we push down decision making to those people who, by virtue of being closest, they have the best information to use their judgment against a filtering system that is almost innate, because culture has created that sort of mental filter of, all right, this is how we do things, right? This is how we make decisions. You don't have to memorize it, because culture makes it second nature. This is just the way we do things around here. So with that, now people are free to use their full potential, their full brain power, judgment, to make the best decisions at closest to the point of impact as possible.
Okay. I was not prepared for this conversation, Nick. I thought we were going to talk about, like, customer conference concentration, you know, diversify your customer base,
well,
do some M&A, all
and
that
so
kind of stuff.
And those things are all real, right? But, and we're talking about, I'm going to make a bad analogy here.
Go ahead. I've made a lot already.
I'm reading a book about calculus now, if you can imagine that, right? And,
oh, you are a mechanical creature, financial creature. You're that cold-blooded person. Don't lie.
It's not a textbook. But the point about that is, right, if you remember, there's derivatives, and you can go different levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got distance, distance, and then the next level is speed or velocity, and the next level is acceleration, right? And then you can go beyond that. But I'm making a painful analogy here to these concepts that we're talking about, which is, right, kind of the first order, the surface, I think, order would be financial performance, cash flows, consistency, all that stuff. But you start taking the derivative to go back to see what's driving these things, and the next level back is exactly what you're bringing up that a lot of buyers are focused on in order to understand, is this performance sustainable? Well, what kind of customer concentration do they have, right? What kind of return on assets do they have? What's their strategy? What's their price point in the market? All that stuff. That's definitely one important level back. But then what is making all those decisions sustainable? Because like we said, those things are good for months or a few years, but you need some engine that is constantly innovating to stay ahead of the pack, right? And that comes from having the right culture, which is reinforced with the right processes that together unleash everyone's potential to have the maximum impact closest to the point of impact as possible.
Well, okay, that makes sense. Everyone else probably dropped off when you said calculus and stopped listening. So, but I'm going to keep going because you got my attention. So,
All right, we may have to edit that part out.
yeah. So it's kind of, I'd imagine sophisticated buyers, the level of sophistication of buyer, the purpose behind a buyer, how willing they are to go in derivatives. Like we're a long-term hold fund. So derivative one is like table stakes. Okay. Do you have cash flows? Are they consistent? Are they enduring? What does the business look like? What's it going to look like in the future? Okay. That's part point one. Next layer down, a lot of this stuff is around customer concentration and how risky is one customer and employee risk. And just
Yep,
that's like
management depth and yep.
management depth and the basics, who's leaving, who's staying, all that kind of stuff. And then the next layer down is really where we got to get to the sustainability of this, right? Tell me this is going to last. Tell me this is can continue to innovate, right? I think continue to build over the long term on what we have and the teams in place to, because whatever product you have is going to change, right? You can still be in that industry, but it's going to change. And
And
you
the
need to
people
change
are going
with
to
it.
change, right?
The
The
people are
people
going to
are going to
change, yeah.
change. So, do you have a cult of personality, or do you have a culture that is so dispersed across the organization that when new people come in, they are going to assimilate to that culture, right? And that's ultimately what you want, is new people will assimilate to the culture because it is so powerful. So that we're not so dependent on any one key person to continue driving, say, a cult of personality.
Yeah, like the key person risk, right? If there's
Right.
one CEO and he's managing the whole thing, well, we have to have a discount. As a buyer, we got to say, okay,
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but if you own 95% of the sales relationship, I can tell you at least 20% are going post-close, right? It could happen. And that's a risk that I have to discount for in my
Absolutely.
valuation as a buyer, right? Super interesting. Well, what else? Is there any other major things when you're thinking sustainable, lasting value that you can give to, how about our CEOs and residents as well
Yeah.
as they're buying and growing companies, but also current owners that are ready to sell, whatever that is. Like, what's the hard,
Let's go
cult
back to
process?
an earlier question of yours that I'm pretty sure I dodged, and that are what are some of the mistakes that I see.
Yeah, pitfalls. Right,
Yeah, the
you did dodge
pitfalls.
it. Thank you
I
for
don't.
calling out yourself on dodging my question.
Right, accountability. So that's one of our core values. It's part of how we define our culture. So there are a few, there's some patterns, sort of repeated, call it mistakes, but I shouldn't even quite say that. And particularly for our audience in West Michigan, with our West Michigan culture and the West Michigan economy, which is very business to business, industrial, often engineering driven. And I can say this because I'm a former engineer, but a pattern that I often see is very strong cultures around customer service, problem solving. We are problem solving engineers who take a lot of pride in customer service and finding solutions for our customers, right? In many cases, that kind of culture, which all sounds positive, right? I mean, what's not to like about that?
I was going to say, I'm waiting for the pitfall here. Yeah, help me out.
Exactly. That kind of culture often leads to customer concentration and actually a bit of a culture of fear rather than a culture of confidence, because the missing piece in that is a sales culture. And often I see companies that kind of have that cultural pattern of customer service, problem solving. I think a good way of summarizing it is a bit of a culture of our quality speaks for itself. We don't need to go shout about it.
That is very West Michigan.
Very, right? Yeah.
That is be
you've
humble.
Seen the,
yeah, I see it in I see it in our universities, right? Mm-hmm. They don't brag about how their quality. I mean, you know, I see it in almost everywhere, right? You don't brag. Be humble. Be kind. Be hardworking.
And there's almost a distaste for sales as inauthentic.
Yes.
And right. And that's a pitfall that I see that severely limits companies in their ability to grow and in their profitability, because they become dependent on those customers. Their margins are inevitably tight. They have no pricing leverage. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, I see sales-driven cultures that inevitably grow much faster. And some of our fastest-growing clients have really been sales-driven cultures. Now, take that to an extreme, and another pitfall that I've seen is a sales-driven culture with no emphasis on profits and cash flow. And so you're sort of missing that accountability piece, right? We're chasing sales for the sake of growth without accountability and discipline around pricing, margins, and cash flow. So there's pitfalls on either end of that spectrum.
Yeah, and it's so weird. One of the key, as a buyer, like one of the key things we look at is who owns the client relationships, right?
Yeah.
It's the engineer. It's the owner. I'm like, wait, what? How does this customer come to you? It's word of mouth. They just come to us.
Right, right. They've come out of the woodwork.
Wait, how big is the market? Like, yeah, so it's, we see it all the time, right? Are you suggesting that there's a balance? You have to balance those two out. Is that probably the ultimate one?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, for sure.
The engineering culture, like you need biz dev, you need engineering, you need marketing, you need it all, right? But yeah, that's a really good answer. Because we see it.
You've seen the same thing we have.
Yeah, it's such a characteristic of West Michigan. Like it's like sales is inauthentic. To use your words, like that's a bad thing. And I'm like, no, it's not a bad thing. It's they're selling a great product to that a customer might not know they even need yet, right?
People need what we do. If you take pride in your work, then you should want to spread that word. Because people need what you do. You are providing a service. You are helping people, and by alerting them to that potential, you're doing them a favor.
Very good. Okay. I'm going to get you one. Any last things that we've missed that you want to talk about before you go to rapid fire? I'm going to tease. I've been trying to get you down to Kalamazoo for an event. We're going to have that. This has been an
It'll
interesting conversation. We went over our time, so it's going to be a longer podcast, but I'm totally fine because I'm intrigued. I want to talk to you about Calcus even a little bit, but we'll save that for a later date.
All right.
Anything you want to mention that an owner, a buyer, something that we haven't talked about yet? Last chance.
Yeah. Oh boy. No pressure there, right? I think you know. Let's speak to the owners in particular. Two things. One, thinking about an exit, thinking about a sale, is often a painful thought process, and owners spend so much time building their business, but not a whole lot of time preparing it for an exit or a sale. So I would encourage owners to entertain those thoughts and those plans, even if it's only hypothetical, much sooner. 5, 10 years before you would even consider selling the company, because the fact of the matter is, the things that make your business valuable in a sale make it valuable and fun for you to own. It's like waiting until you sell your house to do all the remodeling and repairs that you've been putting off. And then you look at it and say, gosh, this house is kind of nice. I wish we could stay here. That same thing, I think, is true for business owners.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Make the business fun to own. And even down to the team, like, start talking about your team in 10 years, in 5 years, like, and then when you're ready to sell, you can roll them under the, we call it under the tent. Like, who else is in the conversation? If the owner's by themselves, I'm like, how are you going to get through diligence?
Right.
Like, you're going to have to tell them eventually, because we're going to request all kinds, like, they're going to know, like,
we're going to want to meet them, right?
Yeah. And we're going to want to meet them and we're going to want to understand them. So yeah, very, that was a very good comment. Like, and we just put a new deck in our house because we're thinking about selling the deck and we've done. I'm like, I want to stay now. This deck is awesome.
All right. Great. Wish we
a
had
great
this 20
example,
years ago.
Right?
Yeah.
We should have done this 2 years ago. And this looks fantastic. We had a friend do our deck. He was so good. It looks so nice right now. Okay. Rapid fire. And then we'll get you out of here, Nick.
All right.
If you go too long, no one will listen anyway, but we might be past that point, but we'll get you down here for an event or we'll figure something out. Okay.
That'd be great.
Favorite leader.
Oh, jeez. Shoot. I should be able to answer that. But I don't know. I'm going to have to pass.
Pass. Okay. I'm going to come back to it at the end.
Come back to that.
Okay.
Jeez.
For a leader.
Rapid fire. All right.
Courage or compassion?
For a leader? Ooh. Compassion, but there's a deep connection between the two.
Okay. Great ideas or great execution?
I'm an ideas person, but great execution is actually more important.
Okay, good. How about, are you a night owl or early bird?
Early bird, more
Early
so
bird?
with each passing year.
Well, yeah. As you get older, you get up earlier. I don't know how that works, but you get up, get a workout in. What's your kind of morning routine?
I think best in the morning. I move best in the afternoon.
Okay. All right. If you're in a challenging situation, so like you're going to enter a dangerous jungle, if you've ever heard that Ray Dalio quote, right? Who would you bring with you? Business. Challenging business situation. Go that way. Or anybody.
My former COO, Kelly.
Kelly, your former COO. Is she
Yes.
retired or is she working somewhere? How do we
We
recruit
ran
her?
we ran out of things for her to fix, so she moved on to take on a law firm with about 10 times the number of people we have. And
Oh.
I think she's doing great things there, but we're still close and share ideas and help each other solve problems all the time.
Send her our way. We got lots of things to fix. Those
Good.
that those are those are lots of problems to fix. Okay. If there was an animal to describe your business style, what would it be?
Okay. Probably, let's say a horse.
Horse. By
A
horse.
horse. Well, I think of our profession requires a fair amount of consistency, and I'm thinking about an animal that can trot along at an even pace without zigging or zagging too quickly.
Okay. Are you ready to answer a word to describe your leadership style? One word.
Hopefully it's compassionate.
Hopefully it's compassionate. Okay. Do you have anything on your favorite leader yet? Did I give you enough time to think through that?
You mentioned Ray Dalio. I've been pretty fascinated by what he's been doing. I'm not, I like his, let me put it this way. I really admire his thought leadership.
His thought leader. I feel the same about that one. His thought leadership makes me think differently about a lot of things. But then you get down to like his dot plots and his charts and all the things he's doing. I'm like, I don't know if I can adopt that. I mean, it's just not something. I don't know if it fit our culture. How's that?
Yes, I agree. And I think, yeah, from a leading people perspective, I think some of what I've read about his ideas and practices might be challenging outside of Bridgewater, but from a thought leadership perspective, he's been fascinating to read.
Yeah, as he his final chapter was chapter that he's in right now of life has really been about deep thought process around some things. His principles book, if you read that cover to cover, it's a long one. I haven't read the latest one on the debt spiral and all that, but
I read
I'm
it in
interested.
pieces as it came out, and it and he's been posting some things lately too that are a little bit unsettling, but we won't go there right now.
Yeah, that's a whole other, when's this thing gonna tip off the edge, right? All right, Nick from Adam Evaluation, managing director, owner, the most known valuation person in West Michigan. That was a fantastic conversation. I'd love to have more with you online or offline. Hopefully I think we're scheduled to be at some event together. I'm not
I
sure how
think
that
so.
worked out yet. And then hopefully we'll do more because I'd love to just sit and have these conversations in front of owners and take questions from them. That would be just such a fun thing for us to do. I think it would benefit a lot of people in our community. We bring some other people and just keep it simple and straightforward and execute. Yeah. All
I'm
right,
all for it.
Nick.
I'm all for it. Well, this is
Thanks.
a lot of fun, Derek. Thanks for inviting me, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Yeah, and if you're an owner or someone that needs evaluation, reach out to Nick and his firm. They are fantastic. So appreciate you joining us, and that was a really insightful conversation, Nick. Enjoy your day, sir.
Cool, you do.
All right, take care.